My name is Tracy Mefford, and I am an alcoholic. And because of this program, really, really awesome sponsorship, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since April the 5th of 1985, and I'm very thankful for that. This has never been my favorite thing to do. I would much rather make the coffee, take out the trash. And that's just the truth of the matter. I've had to kind of come to the place of acceptance that that's not all that God would like me doing. And most of the time I've gotten somewhat okay. Doesn't mean I'm still not terrified anytime I'm getting up, but y'all just may have to bear with me tonight. It's been an extremely difficult year. And one thing that I know beyond a doubt is that when I get up here, I very sincerely pray that God knows the hearts and the minds of the people here. I don't. So speak through me whatever it is that any one person may need to hear, even if that person's me. But in doing so, it's like that channel to God opens. And I've done a lot of closing that off to a certain extent this year. I was on the phone with my sponsor earlier and, you know, just kind of having to come face to face with, holy cow, I've almost been here a year and I feel like I'm just now kind of coming out of a blackout, you know. So anyway, it's a little scarier knowing that just kind of with the way that this past year has gone, but I'm like, okay, you got to get me out of the way of all of this so that whatever needs to be said can be said. I grew up in a small town in East Texas, and I was the youngest of three, but my brother and sister were 15, 17 years older than me, so I was pretty much raised an only child. Had everything I needed, most of what I wanted. You know, I love this program, and I love going to conferences, and for a long time, I didn't know I was actually invited to go to the Al-Anon speaker meeting. I thought that was for them, and one day, somebody like actually said, are you going? And I'm like, well, we're not supposed to, and they informed me that, yes, we could go, and I tell you, I think I've learned more about the family disease of alcoholism listening to an Al-Anon speaker, and I understand today that the home that I grew up in, where there was no drinking, there was no smoking, Daddy only cussed twice, and both of those times it had something to do with me. And, you know, I really do have the ability to make a lot of men do that, though, to be honest with you. That hadn't necessarily changed much. And, you know, but it's like my daddy worked for the same company for, you know, 42 years before he retired. But I know today that that I really grew up in a house that had been affected by alcoholism. My parents, my mom's mom and dad both were alcoholic. My dad grew up with alcoholism in his family. My dad's way of not dealing with things, if you will, was through silent scorn. Now, I didn't know that's what it was called for a long time. I knew that if Daddy got mad at me or he got mad at Mom, he just didn't speak to us. And it wasn't as though it was like good morning, but then didn't get into conversation. He just didn't even acknowledge your presence. And, you know, sadly for my mother, I was going to be giving him a lot of reason to be afraid and angry, which unfortunately meant that she got a lot of silent scorn that had nothing to do with her. That could go on for days or it could go on for weeks. You know, my mom, she was just there, you know. I mean, I was very much the daddy's girl. I mean, I didn't really have a relationship with her and really didn't necessarily bother me one way or the other that I didn't. She was kind of there, and she annoyed me a lot. Both of my parents were super overprotective, and that just could put a squash on a budding alcoholic. And her drinking. And so, you know, I mean, it was like, I mean, I think if I lived there today, there would be a curfew, probably 9 p.m. And maybe I'd get 10 on the weekends. And, you know, it, but I mean, it's just, there were certain rules, you know, of the house. And it was a lot of work drinking, but I loved every minute of it because the job went on all week. I mean, I got to not get in trouble, which is challenging for me. I got to not get in trouble like all week so that I don't get grounded on the weekend. And, you know, I mean, it just, it was a lot of work. And frankly, at that point, I had my first drink at the age of 12. I blacked out my first night drinking. So that was never something that scared me. I just thought it happened to everybody. But it was like, but I remember, in fact, I love going through this book with somebody new and the doctor's opinion in here where it's like that sense of ease and comfort. I mean, I can still take that breath even today thinking about, because I had no idea. I was just wound up in fear and anger and, you know, it was just, I had no idea that any of that stuff was going on. But what I did know was that, man, when I drank, I don't know if I could have told you that I didn't care about what people thought, but I certainly didn't have those feelings that I constantly seem to live with of not quite fitting in. You know, I'm not going to meet up with expectations that people have of me. You know, I've heard many speakers just talk about it. You know, it's like their shoulders coming down from their ears. And it was like just, oh my gosh. And so I could not wait to do that again the next time. And so from my first drink at 12 years old, didn't start drinking daily. But every thought that I had was in regards to alcoholism and when and where. Because again, you're 12, it's a little extra work, you know. Somehow I've always managed to live in dry counties. It still blows my mind. I go into a Walmart and there's like booze in a Walmart. But anyway, I, you know, it was just, it was great. And, you know, growing up, one of the other things that that I remember always feeling was, is that it really didn't matter what was going on in our home. What mattered was other people's perception of what was going on in our home. And needless to say, as I got older, that annoyed me more and more. There were times where, you know, when we would go to church on Sunday mornings, well, heck, we were there all day, pretty much. We had a small lunch break on Sundays, you know, and then we were there for like 3 hours on Wednesday night and, you know, all the time. But after a while, you know, as I got a little older, I was, I don't know, I just found myself getting angry because it was like, Dad may not have spoken to me for a week, but we get to church and he's all, you know, friendly and putting his hand out and how are you doing? Of course, he didn't speak to Mom or I, but to everybody else. And then we'd get back in the car after church and the silent treatment would then pick right back up, you know, and there was this part of me even then that was like, you know what, if you're going to be that way, then be that way. Don't try to pretend that you're something that you're not. You know, and I think that that's where a lot of my defiance came from for a long time. It was like, I may not have thought what I was doing was right, but I wasn't trying to pretend that I was something other than what I was, at least when I got a little bit further into my drinking. You know, I had, like I said, I grew up in the church. I had, I certainly had been taught about God. Frankly, I didn't have any issues with God one way or the other. You know, I just, I mean, God was God, you know. I know today that I didn't have a personal relationship with God. And, you know, later on in my sobriety, I think I've kind of come to the place in looking back because there was a lot of years that I was so resentful at certain religions. I was just resentful at some principles that it seemed to me were talked about, but they weren't actually acted upon. And the hypocrisy, you know, just those kind of things. But at the end of the day, one of the things that I've come to realize is that the reason that the people couldn't teach me to have a relationship with God is because a lot of them, it was very fear-based, and it was this notion that if you do good, if you take the right actions, then God's going to reward that. And I know that today because I've seen some of those people who, you know, school superintendents, you know, principals of high schools. You know, I've seen a few of those where tragedy has struck their family. And one lady in particular, she ended up in a mental institution after her son died for off and on for like a year and a half. And so what I came to realize was is that it's like they were teaching the best that they had. And so, but for me, it quickly, you know, because if you're in as much trouble for thinking it as you are doing it, after a while you say, to heck with that, you know. So if I'm going to think it, I might as well do it, you know. I mean, get full credit. And so I, but again, I didn't have any issue with God. I was, June of 1980, I was 15 years old, and I was standing in the back behind the pulpit and with the choir, and a guy came in, and he had lots of guns. He had clips of ammunition on him, like Rambo kind of. I got to figure out a new something. Y'all got to help me, because I think every now and then it's like, oh my gosh, these young people are like, who's Rambo? So I don't know, maybe Thor? I don't know. Y'all have to help me out. But it's like, and he shouted, this is war, and he turned and he just started firing in the church. And at the end of all of that, there were five that were killed, many others that had been injured. But one of those five was a seven-year-old little girl named Gina Lynham. And I had babysat her and her brother and sister the summer before that, so she felt like my kid. And, you know, it wasn't even that that caused my issue with God. It was probably, it was almost 2 years later, by the time that they brought this guy back to our little small town to get ready to start the trial. And there was a lady going in and seeing him every day. And one day she came out and she said, praise God, he's been saved and he's going to heaven. And if what she said had happened, which was what I had been taught growing up, that here's how you do that. And so if what she said was true, and he was going to heaven, all of a sudden, I wasn't all right with that. You know, I could not make that leap. I love the chapter We Agnostics, because it talks about, you know, our this reasoning, that we really make so many decisions from the very area that my disease centers in my mind, you know. And but it's almost like if I can't get it right here, then I can't get it right at all. And so the spirituality was, that's not up here. And so it's a little hard to grab hold of, you know, initially. But it was like, I just was like, you know what? I'm done with you. I didn't tell my parents or anybody else around me that I was done with God, because that would have like really caused problems with my drinking. You know, but yet everything for me changed. I was 17 years old, and inside, now I had one less something to disappoint. It's just how I saw it. You know, that would not cause me a problem until after I got to you in Alcoholics Anonymous. I graduated high school, probably graduated because I didn't know you could drink on a Thursday until my senior year of high school. You know, once I figured out Thursday was good, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday were too. You know, I got to college, and this is my first exposure outside of my parents' home, and Lord, I mean, I found the Coors distributorship, and they needed a six-pack girl, so my first job, I didn't really get paid in money, but I got paid in beer, and so I was a little promotions girl, hated beer, but, you know, people were willing to swap, you know, make trades with me and stuff, and so, you know, I did so much drinking with so very little money. At some point, I quit going to college. I don't know when exactly. When I got sober, my dad was like, you need to call and get car insurance. And I was like, okay. And they asked me how many tickets that I had or whatever in the last 3 years. I thought it was a trick question. I didn't think anybody knew that, you know, because I mean, I just literally was in so much of a blackout for the majority of the time. I ended up with a job bartending, which frankly in the early 80s, holy cow, I'm so sorry for anybody now, but it was the best gig in the world. I mean, people that work in bars today, they actually expect them to not drink. I can't even imagine that at all, because, I mean, holy cow, I mean, that's just what we did, and it was a blast. I mean, we drank, you know, the manager of the restaurant, you know, the only thing he ever said to me about my drinking was, can you just please get off my good stuff? You are killing me. Just drink the call liquors, will you? And it was like, well, all right, you know. And so that's what I did. And my last 2 years of drinking, at some point in there, I got a DWI. One of my regular customers was an attorney. I used to say, yeah, my attorney got me out like I had him on retainer. But it's just that he was a regular at the bar. And he did. He came and picked me up. In fact, we went to DWI school together. I was the rookie, and he was on his eighth. And so it wasn't until I went to DWI school that I found out that it was a myth that you can't smell vodka. My DWI instructor mentioned that it might be a good idea if I came to DWI school sober. So that was how I found out. But, I mean, that's the insanity that I'm living in. They wanted me to go see this lady, probation officer or something. God knows, I don't know anything about the justice system. And I go see her, and this is 6 weeks before I quit drinking, and she had a list of questions for me. Do you drink, you know, when you're at parties? Sure. You know, do you drink when, you know, when you go out to do social things? And I'm like, drinking is a social thing. And she goes, well, I mean more like bowling. And I'm like, well, I really don't go bowling, but if I did, sure, I would drink. You know, do you drink when you go out to eat? You know, I work in a restaurant, so I don't go out to eat much. If I did, I would. And I mean, it's never occurring to me that I should be lying at all. And so I'm just like, sure. And she's like, do you drink by yourself? I'm like, no, whoa. I don't really care for that. I am a people person. I'm social. So I don't like to drink by myself. I was so excited. I was like, no, I don't like to do that. She said, but would you if no one else was around? Well, yeah, if nobody else was around, and I, you know, if I had to, I would, you know. And the last question that she asked me, I answered just as honestly as I had those. She said, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And I said, absolutely not. And I believe that. I mean, it's really weird thinking back about it now, because, I mean, there were so many things that I didn't know that I knew about alcoholism. But one of those was that alcohol was not my problem. It just wasn't. It was what made my problems go away. My difficulty is not drinking. When I'm not drinking, restless, irritable, discontent, unbelievably so. So if anyone said you have a problem with alcohol, I knew immediately that they didn't have a clue what they were talking about. See, again, I don't know that alcohol doesn't do for everybody what it's doing for me. I mean, I remember many times thinking, I'd give anything if I could get my parents to do a little bit of it themselves. They were a little rigid, you know, and thought it might loosen things up just a bit. You know, I got that DWI. A lot of friends of mine started getting into some pretty serious trouble. So I did like a really courageous thing, and I moved back in with my parents. And, you know, right before I moved back, my mom had called me one day and she said, your daddy's going to bring you your bed. I don't even know how they knew I didn't have one, but I have this apartment. I'm drunk when she tells me this. It's a 2-hour drive for him. I go home to the apartment. I must have passed out. I come to with just banging on the door. I go to the door, I open it. Of course, Dad's not going to be speaking to me. We go to the car, we get the bed, we come in. I'm pretty certain, knowing my dad, he would have helped me set it up. And then he went to leave and he opened the door, but he turned back and he looked at me. And out of just one side of his face that I could see, there was a steady stream of tears going down his face. And I remember thinking as he shut that door, what's your problem? What is your problem? Granted, maybe I'm not living the life that you would have for me to live, but you know what? I'm not doing it, you know, close by to your precious town. So your reputation, all of that, it can stay intact because nobody necessarily knows what I'm doing here, you know? And that literally was what I believed. And I've heard it said in here that, you know, the most selfish, self-centered statement that we can make, I'm only hurting myself. You know, with a son that's an alcoholic and a drug addict, wow, can I tell you that's not the truth. But, you know, I moved in with them and I made a very conscious decision. Again, it was as though I knew what alcoholism was, but I didn't, because it was like, you know what, if I'm going to live here, I've got to not drink. It wasn't, I've got to just have a couple. It was, I need to not drink. And I didn't for 30 days. And I went to a friend, she offered me one, and it's the one and only time that I really meant to have just one. I came out of the blackout three times before that night was over, and all I can tell you is that something happened from that night, and I would not draw a sober breath for the next 6 weeks until I got to you. And I'm telling you, I'm drinking and don't care what anybody thinks, and I cannot tell you how far gone that I have to be to not care anymore, to not worry about mints or whether they're going to know that I'm drinking. I was showing up in Kilgore, Texas, where they thought I was actually still attending college. I'm in the liquor store parking lot at 7:45 in the morning, waiting on them to open at 8 o'clock. I go in, I get my two bottles of vodka, and then I proceed, Miss Social Butterfly, to sit in my car all day and drink. And that's what I'm doing. That's where my life is. I got my second DWI, which is my what happened, if you will. I was on a Friday night, and my parents came and got me out of jail and on Saturday, and I guess it was Sunday. Well, my dad went to our regular church, but my mom, I still don't know whether it was out of embarrassment or she just figured they weren't working, but she took me down the road to a different church that I had never been to. It was the Life Tabernacle Church, and in that church, they lay hands on you, and please do not hear me talking bad about it, because I have not had a drink since. I mean, I tend to think AA's got something to do with that, but you never know. It could have been that. And, you know, and it's like, and it was so amazing to me, because I ended up in treatment right after that. They were the ones that come saw me in the hospital. You know, not where I'd been at the church. You know, as a matter of fact, that day attending the church that I grew up in would be my dad's last day in that church for the next 7 years, because of what people were saying to him about me and that DWI. My mom decided not to let me drive to Kilgore, where she thought I was still attending classes. She drove me there, and when I got there, I had an outer body experience almost. It was like, I can't get out of this car, because if I do, I'll drink. And I actually uttered that to my mother, and she immediately drove to a payphone. I think everybody here is old enough to know what one of those is. Do you realize we're going to have to explain that one of these days? It's like, if you see one, wipe it off. You don't know who had it before you. It, you know, anyway, there's so many skills that the younger kids don't have to worry about today. But I will say, you know, I am kind of happy about the cell phones and the GPS, because don't think I won't know where my daughter is. You know, Lord, I'm so glad they didn't have that then. And, you know, but what happened is she drove there. She found a psychiatrist, psychologist, somebody, and we drove straight there. And by 6 o'clock that evening, I'm in the detox ward of PNS Hospital in Shreveport, Louisiana. Mad, because whatever that little momentary thing that had happened was, it was gone. We were at the psychiatrist's office like at 9 o'clock in the morning. Shreveport's only like a three and a half hour drive, but we had to go shopping because again, it's all about perception. And by gosh, I had to be the best dressed person going into treatment, you know, and I was, you know, I got in there and. And I'm just thinking, golly, what am I doing here? There were people that would come tell their stories. And I just remembered thinking, I didn't know anything about alcoholism yet. You know, again, still had some perceptions of that it couldn't be me. But there was something in those people's eyes. And at the time, they would allow people from AA to come up and just come and sit with us, you know, in the day rooms and just visit with us. And it was some of the kindest people that I'd ever met in my life. And, you know, I ended up getting a home group. And, I mean, I got on fire, you know. I learned about what alcoholism was. And I caught it after arriving, you know, at least in regards to my own experience with it. And, you know, just really, really active. I had a sponsor. And one of the things I was thinking about today that I am most grateful for is that the principle of repetition, strengthening and confirming, and faith then coming naturally. Because there were things that I thought were pretty ridiculous, like a sponsor saying, call me every day. Wow, I don't have that much to say to you. You know, that's my thought. But I did it just because she told me to, you know, being at a meeting every day. Why? Because I didn't have a life and what else did I have to do, you know? And so I did that. When the time would come a little over a year later, it would save my life. And frankly, it's done a little bit of that in this year. Because there are just some things that I can't not know anymore. And that, when one thing for sure is that when I suit up and I show up and I reach my hand out, I will find my new family. Okay. So, you know, I'm rocking and rolling, and I met a guy in treatment. They suggest highly that you don't do that, but I did, and we married. You know, no major decisions for the first year, so in 15 months, we got married, and I mean, you know, and as a matter of fact, at 15 months sober, I moved to Georgia for the first time. God Almighty, Rebus was my home group. God, well, I'm 28 years sober. 15 months sober, you guys do the math. And wow, if anybody remembers me from then, I'm so sorry. God is really amusing because he has put like a lot of these young people in my path since I've been here that it's like, oh, really? Oh, wow, I was just like that. You know, I will say the one thing I had going for me was energy and enthusiasm. A lot of cockiness, a lot of thinking I knew everything. But thank you, God, for the old timers that helped to channel. If I'd have known they were doing it, I probably would have balked. But they were just really cool that way. You know, it's like where they would just, hey, Tracy, you could really help us out by going over here. Well, of course I can, you know. And so, you know, I was really busy a lot, you know, and thank God you gave me lots of opportunities to be busy. And you know, I guess I got pregnant not long after we got here, and I was 6 months pregnant. My husband calls me to tell me he's been shooting dope for the last 6 weeks, and I'm devastated. I'm like, you know, in my mind, we're done. I cannot believe you did this to me. And, you know, didn't end it at that point, but 6 months after my son was born, he left. And the only reason he wasn't gone sooner is because I just had not manipulated it well enough to get him gone sooner, because it was very crucial who left. That was very crucial. If you are with someone in the program and there is a breakup, first person to the home group wins. You get your story out there, then anything else that comes behind it sounds like utter rationalization and justification. Sadly, that can be the case a lot. I don't tend to live by that principle today, but it was definitely the case then. And, you know, I ended up walking into AA, and there were people that, you know, I'd known for quite some time that just quit speaking to me. It doesn't help when they go to the psychiatric ward of a hospital, like, because they want to kill themselves. That, you just really have no shot at that point, you know, because, I mean, it was obviously my fault. I had done this to him. Again, I'm so grateful for this program. I'm so grateful for a God of my understanding that I kept coming. And You know, an amazing thing happened. You know, I had started recognizing that I might have to have this relationship with God, but I had picked up on the, you know, group of drunks. And one thing I knew is when I'm with you, I won't drink. But if I leave you, I just had a knowing that I would drink. And then the good orderly direction, you know, so it was like, perfect. I got two gods, you know, group of drunks giving good orderly direction. And that worked. It worked beautifully, actually, until it didn't. And when it's the way that you know that stops working is that when you go to meetings, you don't just automatically feel great when you leave. Or I'd pick up the phone and I'd call my sponsor and blah, you know, and then I'd feel great when I hung up. You know, I'm certain they probably told me to go read something or do some writing, but I am not about extracurricular or extra credit work. If me calling you makes me feel better, whew, thank goodness, got past that one, you know. And so, you know, there's a lot of things I'm certain I was told to do, but I wasn't doing it. And all of a sudden, that magic wasn't happening for me anymore. And I'm sitting in here, and people think that because of how well that I talk the talk, that there's an assumption that I knew how to walk the walk. And my pride, one day at a time, almost killed me coming to meetings every day. Because I didn't know how to say, I don't know how to do this. I didn't know how to say that I am so disappointed when I wake up in the mornings because I just want to die. And I know that I don't have the courage to be able to do that. There were times with that son of mine that I would think, God, why? I don't want him. You know, it's just, God, please, I can't do this. And then there would be other days that I would think, I don't know that I'm still here if it's not for him. And I tell you, the G-O-D that was going to mean the world to me on that given day was the gift of desperation. Because that night, when I was in my apartment sitting on the floor with my knees to my chest and I'm rocking back and forth, I mean, the emotional pain is so great. I'm hurting physically. And what came out of my mouth was, God, help me. Because, see, I had thought, you know what, maybe what it says in here that some of you that just kind of neatly evaded God, he'd forgive that, you know, you just kind of drank your way up from the church, man, he's all for that, he's about, yeah, come on, that's great, but somehow, again, our own terminal uniqueness, but because I had made a very conscious choice, I'm done with you, he wasn't going to help me, and so that line that is so excruciating of, I know I need you, but I do not believe that you are going to be there for me. And that gift of desperation came that night with that pain that great. And I did. I called out and said, God, help me. And wow, did he ever. You know, at the end of the day, again, we agnostics, where it talks about, you know, that anyone who seeks him, anyone, it is open to them. And as a matter of fact, when I said, God, help me that night, it was like I had this thing that got put in my head to go to We Agnostics and to read that. And for the first time, I joined you in feeling like that your solution was going to be able to be my solution. And, you know, about that same time, my sponsor got a new sponsor, and I don't know if you've ever had that happen, but wow, stuff rolls downhill. You know, they get on fire about something, and now they're going to get you on fire, you know. And it's almost like you got a new sponsor, really. But thankfully, I was in a place where I welcomed that and going through the steps. And, you know, again, like with everything else in this deal, you know, I start thinking, oh, yes, I got it going on, me and God, like that, you know. So then I start thinking everything around me, oh, that's a God deal. You know, oh, I got that parking spot. Wow, that's a God deal, you know. You know, as the old lady behind me, I'm one of those now. Anyway, you know, as if I'd really been paying attention, there was somebody that could have used that close parking spot a whole lot more than I could have. But I don't, oh, no, God got me that parking spot. And so what starts to happen is that anything that comes to your mind, you really do think, wow, God, you're good. And I was still here in Georgia, and a guy pulled up with Texas plates on his car. Holy cow, that was a God deal. And, you know, and so 6 months later, we were married, and I moved to Winston-Salem, North Carolina for 6 months, back to Dangerfield, Texas for 6 months, Shell Knob, Missouri for 2 months, just touring the United States via U-Haul, and I was crazy. I was insane. We got to the Dallas-Fort Worth area 5 years before my 8th birthday, and wow, did I need to get there. You know, I was able to get a sponsor. In fact, it's the same sponsor that I have today. Man, I tell you what, God had just the perfect person just for me. She had higher expectations of behavior for me than I had for myself. She really seemed to believe that I could do certain things that I didn't think I could do. And it's amazing when we have someone that has that belief, and that also believes in some sort of higher power or God that we have the chance to get. It's like, it really is amazing how somehow there just seems the ability to rise to the occasion. I always think about, I used to play tennis, and I got beat worse than I'd ever gotten beat in a long time. But I'm telling you, I played the best tennis of my life that day because her game raised mine. And that's really what's happened to me in this program, is how important I know that it is to have those people in my life that make me raise my game, that aren't like, oh yeah, you're coming every day, you're doing this or you're doing that, so that's great. You know, no, if today ever becomes good enough, then I'm headed backwards down the hill away from you. And I believe that with all of my heart. Me, a year ago, won't stay sober a year from now, 5 years from now. I don't know exactly how long, but I don't want to have to try that out to see. You know, it's like I have to keep those heroes or those people in front of me that continue to say, you can do this, even when I don't think that I can. I was still on marriage number two. The sponsor, she started telling me actions to take, and that I couldn't act ugly even when he acted ugly. I couldn't scream and cuss at him when he did at me, and it was like, I'm like, you're just turning me into a doormat's what you're doing. And actually, you know what it was? What she did was she started having expectations of better principled behavior, and here's what she knew. That even when his behavior continued, that when mine stopped, all of a sudden, I start seeing my reflection in the mirror. All of a sudden, I am feeling differently about me. And all of a sudden, I start to realize for the first time in my life that honestly, that no other person's got the ability to just completely wreck me. I'm the one that does that. Through my actions, it didn't matter. I can't tell you. I mean, it seemed like the mantra of my life was, you know, if they didn't do blank, I wouldn't do blank. God, I'm not asking for a perfect guy here, just decent. Is that too much to ask? Well, with the one I was married to, yes, it was. You know, but at the end of the day, again, why was I there? How did I get into those circumstances? Because I made decisions based on self that later put me in a position to be harmed. Oh my gosh, that third step in our big book. And that was the truth of the matter. He ended up having an affair with a gal that I sponsored. And you know what? I can't even tell you, it turned out to be the best thing that could have ever happened. I was a little angry at the time. I wasn't feeling real grateful about it at that point. I was actually more upset with her than I was him, you know. But it ended up being the best gift, because it was like the one thing I knew I had not given everything to my first marriage. I had decided, done, you know, and I believed that I had to give everything. I didn't get to just walk away again. But by the time that happened, I had started taking those different actions. And so when that happened, I knew that it was okay to walk away. I knew that I had given everything that I had to that, and it was just now time to walk away. These relationships that I was in off and on, that little boy of mine, I'm jerking him through every one of them with me. Still somehow with the mindset of the alcoholic that if I am hurting anybody, it's only me. And I'm dragging him through these relationships just as well. it becomes a little bit more difficult to have to get honest with yourself through writing and inventory and talking with your sponsor to realize the harm that you've done to your child, and you hadn't touched one drop of alcohol. But again, thank you for these steps, because in working these steps, I got freed from guilt. That boy was 9 years old when I sat him down to make my amends to him. A few years ago, I asked him, I said, do you remember me making amends to you? He told me the restaurant where we were. I couldn't have told you that. He told me what I had on, what clothing that I had on. He told me what clothing that he had on. Don't tell me that it doesn't work, because I'm here to tell you there was going to be some times over the next several years that had I been still living in that guilt, I very possibly could have killed my son. Because if you're in jail, it's my fault. I mean, if I'm guilty, if I haven't dealt with that and you're there, I can't leave you there. It's my fault that you're there. You know, and on that went, and countless arrests, and, you know, we kept saying, you're not coming to get you after you're 17, and right after 17, you know, he goes in. I skipped ahead just a little bit, but, I mean, it's so crucial, that time that I had with him, and for the first time in my life, I was okay with not being in a relationship. I was okay with it just being me and Aaron. I was even okay if it was me and Aaron for the rest of my life. I can't tell you the freedom that came from that. And, you know, so everything started changing. And I was GSR from my group, and we were going to area assemblies, and I met this little cute guy. They're really awesome men. I'm married to one, an alcoholic today, but he is my third. I say that he is also my last. He introduces me as his first wife, which I am, to keep me honest. And I introduce him as my last husband. I don't really care how that's got to happen, but one way or the other, you're my last. And he tells me all the time, I'm more dead, more dead than I am alive. It's like, you better stop telling me that, you know. But, you know, it's like, but you know what? I did things differently. I didn't jump in the sack with somebody, because you know what? Here's the thing. I don't see you clearly once I've done that. It's like I've got these, oh, thanks for the glasses. I hope they're somewhere up here. Oh, yeah. Well, anyway, so it's like, but it's like I put on a pair of glasses once that physical stuff comes in, and all of a sudden how I see you is tinted. I don't see the truths that maybe I need to see, or behaviors that aren't okay with me, principles that I've learned that are important to me and that I live by. You know, my sponsor told me no sex for the first 6 months, no problem. I always think that before the first date. And then, you know, it gets a little dicey after that. They put your hand on your leg and it's like, you know, kind of thing. And I was like, fine. She said, that's no holding hands or kissing either. Wow, that's a little extreme. But you know what? We didn't do it. And I'm here to tell you that I'm still married to that man today, because of the time that we spent getting to know each other. I'm still married to that man because we did go through a really rough patch. You know, we were separated for 6 months after my daughter Rachel was born. Just some things that went on in his own life and in his relationship with God. But I'm telling you, it's like I have not learned anything of significance. God, we're about to be married in April, 15 years, and I have not learned anything of significance since the first 4.5 months that we dated. I mean, when you can't touch, Lord, I mean, there's just not a whole lot else. You know, it's just talk. You know, and we did, and I'm so very grateful. So grateful for that. We did get married. It was my first marriage that my sponsored parents were all happy. And, you know, that's another thing. If, like, your sponsor's not real keen on it, you might consider it. I'm just saying. We always think, oh, they just don't see what we see, you know. Anyway, we got married and, you know, it was great. And I think we just kind of started letting some things, you know, taking advantage of things or not committing to the amount of time or the sharing with each other. And in the meantime, that's when my son's going crazy and left. And, you know, like I said, let's see, I was going to give birth to my daughter in December, and it was October when he got arrested after he turned 17. I had my daughter December the 18th of 2004. And 5 days later, I had her by C-section, and 5 days later, I was up trying to walk up the stairs to Denton County Courthouse to go spend 20 minutes with my son on Christmas. And I remember coming home, and I've got this week-old baby in my arms, and I've got tears coming down my cheeks. And my mother-in-law just looks at me, and she said, "Tears of joy or tears of heartache?" And I said, "I think it's a little of both." And he eventually got out of jail. You know, still wasn't doing some of the things that he needed to do. And at the end of the day, he did get clean for a period of time, almost 2 years. And wow, that was an amazing period of time. We found out his girlfriend was pregnant, so we got a grandbaby. And at 8 months old, the grandbaby was. My grandbaby's mom called her mom to say, "We're not being very good parents," and they were putting her down in the crib and then leaving the apartment and going out and drinking. And then they started shooting heroin. And, you know, we took her. It's one thing to get to the place of letting go, and believe me, there are so many levels to that. But then having to let go, but also then now I've got to stand for a child that doesn't have a voice, which is going to pit me directly across from my son, from my own child. Again, man, this program, the steps, God of your understanding, it will meet you no matter what, no matter what. And, you know, I was able to just, he had to do what he had to do, and she lived with us. I tell you, it was the worst, though, just in not realizing that at 8 months old, this baby, if she lost sight of me, she screamed as though someone was stabbing her. It's like, tell me, I think it was like this knowledge of, oh my God, just how young that we affect these little ones, and how alcoholism just is devastating, you know, even to ones that haven't celebrated their first birthday. And they got arrested, and I was sitting in court the day that my son got sentenced to prison. And just one day at a time, you know, you guys were with me. Just not just, oh, I'll be there. It was taking my hand, and it was going to the courthouse with me. Or it was going to take me to see him for the first time, because you knew I wasn't going to be able to drive home that night. And, I mean, just every step of the way. I cannot express. One of the other things that I praise, it's like, God, please, let the love and the enthusiasm that I have for this program come shining through when I talk, because I'm telling you, the life that it has afforded me, in spite of total insanity, much of which was of my own making. I mean, it's just mind-boggling to me, the power of this. But it is very much in the we. It's got to be about the we. And, you know, my son did get out of prison. He's not in prison right now, and you know, he's drinking a little. I did inform him that his daughter was telling on him, you know, so I wasn't sure if he knew that his daughter was now old enough to go, "My daddy's breath stinks." "Really, baby? What does it smell like?" "It smells like beer." And I'm like, I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying, if you think that that's a secret, just saying it's not, you know. And he's like, "Oh, no, it's fine. You know, I'm doing all right. I'm just having, you know, a few drinks." And it's like, all right, baby, however I can help, you know, I love you. To be able to still treat him with kindness and compassion. It's not me. It's not me. I don't have the ability to do that. You know, my parents, I had a hard time having a relationship with them, but towards the, I don't know, it was somewhere before Aaron went to prison, it's like I realized that I had not completed the amends process with my parents, is why I still was having such a hard time, and it was about the money that I owed, and I started paying that money back, and thankfully with the amends, you know, the freedom comes with the first check, not the last, and I was able to have that relationship with my mom and my dad, and, you know, my dad passed away, and you know what? My mom, I'm the baby, but my mom couldn't do anything till I got there. You guys gave her a daughter that she could be proud of. I used to think, you just don't accept me the way that I am. You know, you judge me, and if I'm doing what you think I should be doing, then, oh, everything's fine, you like me. But if I'm not, then it's like, then you're just all, you know, ugly to me. And you know what? It wasn't that at all. she wanted to be able to truly just be my mom. But instead, it was this constant battle of, why is she doing this? It doesn't make sense. This isn't what we taught her. You know, what? And today, my mom, and again, this is not about me. This is what you guys gave her. She can call the neighbor and go, yeah, Tracy was out raking the yard. You see her? She's proud. It's like she, for the first time, can feel some pride and not have that just horrible guilt that she lived with, thinking, oh my God, this is all my fault. You gave her that. There's a story in the back of the book, which is one of my absolute favorites. It's called The Keys of the Kingdom. And I'm going to read just a little bit of it. It says here, in the last several years of my life, they've been rich and meaningful. I've had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that is life. But I have also known a great deal of joy and a peace that is the handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, old and new, and unusual, with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related, first through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. As the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligation, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness. With that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and need never return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys of the kingdom. Thank you.